whole people can disagree, and so this morning I want to urge both sides to recognize that there's legitimate value in the diversity of opinion that's in the room, and so I hope that all good people this morning will give sophisticated, reasoned responses to testimony that they hear, and so on and so forth. That way we'll have a good hearing, and we won't have any name-calling or whatever.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Oh, come on.
Yes, go ahead.
We have on our packet an A2, A3, and A4 amendments. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Do you want to comment on that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, yeah. I failed to note that you do have three amendments at your seat. The dash A2s applies the food labeling restrictions to labels that occur on or after the effective date. The dash A3 amendments delete the term impose as far as local or state governments imposing labeling restrictions and replace that with that they may not adopt or enforce such labeling requirements, and also applies the language to labeling occurring after the effective date. And finally, the dash A4s exempts the Oregon Liquor Control Commission labeling requirements for wine from the bill's food labeling restrictions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Would it be correct to assume then that the A3 is kind of replacing the A2s? If we adopted that, we would not need the A2s?
They have the duplicative Section 2 in both amendments. Yes, Senator Byer.
Thank you.
Okay. What I'll do is, what I've done before, I'll have positive or for those for and those against, trying to alternate those as much as possible as we take testimony this morning. With that, the proponents of the bill, Joe Gillum, I'd invite first. Maybe we'll do this two at a time, have two yeses. The next person on here is Rob Miller. So if you two gentlemen would come, and then we'll follow that with a couple of folks that...
Mr. Chair, let's do two yeses, one no, then two no's, one yes. I mean, I think we should vary this a little bit.
I'm glad that somebody handed me this, because this will mean that next time... the good senator wants to chip in. I can just munch on these.
Oh, I think the discussion will drive me crackers. There's no question.
It's a crummy discussion.
Yeah.
Any way you look at it.
You can do it.
Food for thought.
You want to try to compete here, Joe? Go ahead.
I'm just going to let it lie. Mr. Chair, member of the committee, for the record, Joe Gilliam, representing the Oregon Grocery Association. We brought this bill forward to the legislature, and it has come through the House on a 43-8 vote and had a lot of support for it. I'll get to the bag in a minute, but what we want to discuss is the United States food labeling system is extremely important in how we distribute food and how consumers get the information. The Oregon Grocery Association is very concerned how that system works, that it works properly, and we also support the right for people to know what's in their food. But for a credible labeling system to work, it must ensure that the information on the label of the package is accurate, based in science, and evaluated by independent experts. It must also allow for efficient delivery of consumer products, and it should not disadvantage Oregon food processors and manufacturers or damage Oregon employment, unnecessarily increase cost to consumers. Those are the tenets of a good labeling system. Our system is a national system, and any information on the system should be approved and evaluated. Unfortunately, the local jurisdictions and the state of Oregon don't have the resources or the expertise or the ability to evaluate food labels and to make sure that they pass and meet the scientific standards and evaluations that need to happen on the labels. Many of these efforts to not go through the FDA or USDA or do local labeling are attempts to go around that process. And what you end up is nothing more than opinion or conjecture on behalf of people that have been mandated on products that give information that may be, maybe useless, but at worst be misleading. And that is a real danger when consumers are looking at their products. In addition, by establishing local requirements, these laws disadvantage Oregon companies that are exporting their foods either to other jurisdictions or other states that may not allow those kinds of labels that are unapproved by FDA or USDA on their shelves. And then our Oregon companies who have Oregon products can't sell their products outside or have to make a completely different product, different package for that, for their products, which many times is just economically unfeasible to do. It works in reverse for national products coming into Oregon. If they have to have a Coos County only label, it just may not be economically feasible to put that product in Coos County, and distribution and consumer choice goes down. This bill does protect consumers by supporting label requirements approved by the FDA and USDA and prohibiting local labeling laws that bypass their approval process. It protects Oregon businesses and their employees by prohibiting local labeling requirements that make their products unmarketable. It also protects consumer choice by prohibiting local labeling requirements that might otherwise make it financially unfeasible to offer national products. It does not prohibit the Oregon Department of Agriculture from imposing Oregon-only standards when the federal government has not addressed a given issue. Now, that's happened before, and this wouldn't change that. In sulfites and pull date labeling, the federal government had not yet addressed those issues. The ODA stepped in and said, we're going to have some standards here. And then when the FDA came in with their standards, they adopted them, so we're on a national system. It also, while we're concerned with the statewide initiatives coming in and disadvantaging our companies, statewide initiatives will still be allowed under the bill. I'd like to just to kind of outline, you know, some of the arguments around this, just to clarify kind of the form, if you will. If you look at that package of chips, I didn't just bring you snacks this morning, but if you look at that package of chips, on the front of the package are issues that have been addressed by the FDA, organic, on the lower half of the package. To be organic, the FDA said it is appropriate that standards be put into place so people know what organic means, because there are all these different statewide organic standards, and they said we got to have one standard, which Oregon ultimately adopted. Under that, one of the big issues is GMO, and they said, you know, there is no health risk to GMO, there's no proven health risk, there's no scientific data to back that. However, for something to be labeled organic, it cannot be genetically modified. And people need to know that, so if they want to make a choice, they have that information. And so if you put an organic label on there, you're allowed to put the GMO label on the bottom right-hand corner of that package to tell people, here's your consumer choice. Now, on the back of that package is the information that goes directly to health and safety issues that has been approved by the FDA and USDA that should be on a package based on science and the evaluation they go through. And those are your health, your saturated fat, your vitamins, and all those items there on the right-hand panel. So there are really two different levels in which you meet. And having a federal standard to go through there, to go through the process, to make sure that it's appropriate to have it on the package is very, very important to the food distribution system. You're going to hear from Oregon companies, experts in this field, to tell you why this is important. With that, I'd like to turn over to Rob Miller or answer your questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I do appreciate looking at this, and I mean that's what.
Would you put that down, please? It's making a lot of noise. Trying to read over here.
Well, I'm sorry to interrupt your morning coffee. I was going to observe that after reading all that, it just hit me that I'm doing a fast all day to identify with hungry people, and then. Great way to start.
Chair Shields, I almost brought in Ben and Jerry's ice cream to show you their label, so I did spare you that.
That would have been cruel.
That would have been cruel and unusual. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Go ahead, sir.
For the record, I'm Rob Miller, president of Trailblazer Food Products. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to talk to you today about an issue that I think is vital to the Oregon economy and to jobs. As I begin, I'd like to tell you a little bit about our company. We're based in Multnomah County. Right on the Gresham-Portland border, we produce over 25 tons of jams, jellies, preserves, syrups, and Thai fillings per day at our single facility. We employ approximately 50 people in a variety of functions, production, warehousing, customer service, and management positions. We're proud to offer living wage jobs with a fully company-funded health care plan, 401k plan, a cafeteria benefit plan for all of our full-time employees. Economically, we hope to sell over $17 million today or this year of Oregon-made goods. And give given the very small profit margins in our business, we're going to invest most of our top-line dollars, if not all, right back into the economy. Many of those dollars right back in the Oregon economy in form of wages, things we buy from local suppliers, and, of course, taxes. All in all, we think we're the kind of company that the state of Oregon would like to promote. I come to you today in support of House Bill 2957 for one reason and one reason only. The support of this bill is critical to Trailblazer Foods and other Oregon food processors are to survive. The bill is simply designed to prevent a son of Measure 27 from passing on the local level. I know you have and you will hear testimony from both opponents and proponents of this bill, so I'll keep my comments brief and focused on the single most important issue that I think revolves around this issue, and that's jobs in the Oregon economy. Our business is really simple. We make jams, jellies, and preserves. We try to make them as efficiently and inexpensively as possible, and we sell them under our brands and the brands of our customers, also known as private label. Now, I'd like you to imagine you're a buyer for a major grocery store chain, and you've gone out and done your due diligence and decided that we are, for quality and value and all the things we provide, we're the best company to make your brand a jam. And you sell this brand in 20-plus states. You're happy with what we're doing, and it's a multi-million-dollar business in Oregon and the Oregon economy, or multi-million-dollar business for us. Now, imagine that because of a local measure that passed, I now have to put a label on anything made, sold, shipped through Oregon. So everything I make, I have to put a warning label on. Now, I'm shipping it to California, Texas, Canada, Mexico, but it has to have that label on it. I have no doubt that that buyer is going to go out and find a new supplier for this product. And if that happens, we would be faced with some tough decisions. Do we move out of that local jurisdiction, or do we try to survive through the laws? I can tell you that a local measure that passed in Multnomah County would seriously put our ability to compete. It would virtually eliminate our ability to compete. So I would ask you today to consider carefully the implication of jobs in the economy of this bill, to support House Bill 2957, and I will offer you any support I can, any resources I have that can help you understand the issues that face companies like mine if this type of labeling law were to pass. Thanks.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
Sir, the only question I'd have is any of the product you use now genetically modified?
It's tough to know. The reality is the genie is out of the bottle in genetically modified organisms. There are two main suppliers of corn syrup, which is a very pervasive ingredient in foods. There's two suppliers in the country, and neither of them will certify that their corn is GMO-free. So anything you buy with corn syrup in it cannot, will not be certified as GMO-free. So I couldn't tell you it's GMO-free because we use a lot of corn syrup.
Right. That was the question I was asking.
Yeah. So, in essence, I think the Starlink corn is so pervasive that there's certainly going to be trace amounts in any product that contains corn syrup.
Thanks. Mm-hmm.
Other questions?
Mr. Chair, I think, you know, to that issue, Senator Corcoran, is if the federal government, FDA or USDA, were to say, here's the science, here's the basis, we want you to label GMO, and they did it at a federal level, then we would do that. And we would comply and be about our business. It's more the mechanics of it rather than is GMO good or bad. You know, we're not here to argue that, but we do believe there has to be a system that you have to make the case and get the approval, and we have a national system, so it should just be the mechanics should work that way.
Do you think Representative Close's definition of science will help us along that?
Senator, if I could just add, I could support a GMO bill on a federal level because it eliminates virtually all the issues I talked about.
Yeah, I tend to be there with you on that. I agree.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm going to call Rick North and it looks like Kate Miller. They would come.
You got Przanski here. You want to let him testify?
Oh, is Floyd here? Hang on. Let's. Okay.
I'm going to take 2 minutes.
Okay.
This is Representative Floyd Przanski, a.k.a. Abe Lincoln.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senators. I just wanted to put a couple things on the record. This bill, as you know, came from the House. There's a few things that were stated on the floor, and one area that I forgot to really ask the carrier of the bill, and I think this is the part that I want you to try to focus on, is the Section 2 of Section 1 or Subsection 2. Basically, I believe this bill is bad for Oregon, and the reason I think it's bad is because it will, in fact, limit Oregonians' information that I think they have the right to know. When the bill was heard on the House side, there was issues that were discussed, and you've heard from the two previous speakers as to the control or the concerns of local government imposing a stricter standard. Clearly, when the carrier of the bill was asked as to what or where has this occurred in the state of Oregon, they said it has not, and they had no knowledge of any place where that was looking to attempt to have local labeling laws imposed. But I think the most important thing, again, is the subsection 2, because that is actually a component that was not discussed in any great detail on the House floor as to the impact of the state having the ability to have additional requirements than are stricter than what is provided for under the federal law. And to me, this is a Trojan horse, because it basically will, in fact, impact Oregonians' right to know where we as a state decide that that this information is appropriate or should, in fact, be included on the labeling. Our state would not be able to have a stricter or a more broader disclosure than what the federal labeling laws would provide. The best example I think I can give to you from my own knowledge is what Oregon Tilth has been able to do and demonstrate as to being one of the leaders in the country when it comes to genetics, labeling, and getting information to individuals. It's my opinion that Oregon Tilth, as well as the its equivalent in California, is what was the driving force to make the changes that we've seen on the federal level of identifying our organic products. And I think that if we do not allow for that flexibility within our state, that we will in fact could diminish the ability for these organizations to get information to us. And I think Senator Corcoran has brought up a great example as to genetic modified food. I was able to attend a conference in March where genetic foods were part of the multiple panels that were presenting at the conference. And it's just amazing to me as to exactly where we're heading as a country. And I think it's only fair for individuals to have that information, to be able to be informed and make a decision that's conscious based on the information that can be provided to them. I find that this type of restriction could, in fact, prohibit and inhibit individuals from being informed.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Byers.
Senator Byers, I'm sorry. It's been a long day, I know.
Yeah. The fast has begun.
Representative, the fast. The fast has made him slow. Representative, the question that I would have for you is, from a problem-solving standpoint, my personal views of genetically modified food aside, how do you handle the issue that, take a national product that has, I suppose you could say almost any breakfast cereal probably has corn syrup in it, which is probably genetically modified, and Eugene, you know, the home of granola and Birkenstocks, decides to pass a local ordinance that says that you have to identify genetically modified food. I just can't see how large retailers and grocers would be able to, you know, go to Kellogg and say, for our Eugene sales, you need to put a special label on here saying it's genetically modified. I'm just having a problem trying to figure out, from a rational standpoint, how we get over that hump.
Mr. Chair and Senator Corcoran, I guess what I would say is that, first of all, there's no local jurisdictions in the state that are currently or in the process of requiring these type of labels. Now, if this committee believes that that's an issue, you can take the bill, you can take Section 1 and leave that in under Subsection 1-1 and still take out the Subsection 2. This is the Trojan horse that I'm referring to. What you've heard so far and what, well, that's not true. What we heard on the floor, and the thing that I think that can be misleading, is that you're going to hear from the proponents of this bill that all the fear that they have as to what's happening at the local level or could happen at the local level. The reality is you have to look at the bill in its entirety to see how broad it really is. And it does, in fact, limit the state from being able to have anything that is more informative than what the federal labeling would require. And so, if
you give me an example of how that would, I mean, it seems to be what you're saying is that you would accept sub 1, but you'd like to delete sub 2.
I'm saying my personal view is if this committee believes that there is an issue here as to the local jurisdictions, deal with the local jurisdiction issue. Don't prohibit the state from being able to have a requirement that may be stricter and giving more information to Oregonians.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Who's next?
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm, yes. Thank you for coming, Representative Prusansky.
So I'll give it written fast and warning to do.
Yes.
I won't get that one. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Rick North. I'm a resident of Durham, Oregon, and I'm here as a concerned citizen in opposition to HB 2957. I wanted to start off by just telling a personal story about how I ended up here. Nearly 2 years ago, I was researching information for a program at our church on how our eating habits and food buying habits affect the environment, our health, and the plight of local farmers. As you all know, local farmers here in Oregon and around the country have been really hurting for many years. What I found out, I was absolutely astonished. I couldn't believe what I was reading, hardly, on how many problems there were associated with our food system, how many health dangers, how many environmental dangers. And what stood out, something I hadn't really looked at before, was genetically engineered foods. And in that category, this was not even the main thrust of our program, but it was just something that I noticed. And what really stood out was something called recombinant bovine growth hormone in milk. And this is a substance that some dairy farmers inject into their cows, which makes them produce milk at a rate typically 10 or 20% more than what a natural cow would produce. That's the intended effect. The unintended effects are that it produces mastitis at a higher rate in cows that take this, an infection, and their cows often have to be given antibiotics to overcome these infections, which then can be passed on to human beings drinking the milk. But equally or even more serious, RBGH produces a growth factor. It's called IGF-1. And this growth factor has been linked to all kinds of cancers, breast cancer, colon cancer, prostate cancer, and many others. I don't want to overstate the case. There has not been absolute proof that this increased production of IGF-1 absolutely is causing these cancers, but there have been many, many studies all over the world showing this high correlation rate. And what has happened because of this is that nearly every industrialized country in the entire world has gone beyond labeling milk that has RBGH in it. They've actually banned it because they consider it such a danger to the health of the people in their countries. But in the United States, we are not only not labeling this, but we're not only allowing it, we're not even labeling it, so that most people that drink milk will not even realize if this milk has RBGH in it. I couldn't believe this, and where it really hit home, not just for the country as a whole, my wife has two sisters with breast cancer. So she is genetically, automatically at a higher rate for getting, or at a higher risk for getting breast cancer, as is our daughter. And we have been drinking this milk and not even knowing it. I was outraged that this was going on. And what was even more embarrassing is that I had been working for the American Cancer Society for 21 years, the last six as the state director for Oregon, and I'd never heard of this stuff. That's how unknown it was to me. And I had things on cancer crossing my desk every day.
Excuse me. In other words, it's not that you weren't looking at the issue. It's just that it was obviously kept very quiet. Is that what you're saying?
It just has not gotten a whole lot of play in the media. As genetically engineered foods in general, compared to the rest of the world, where it's often front page news on a weekly basis, and it's a topic of common conversation. So, with that, I really started researching for the better part of 2 years. I've done a lot of intensive research on genetically engineered foods. And again, the issue here is not whether you might agree. I have very serious concerns, both in terms of human health and the environment, on genetically engineered foods. You may or may not share those concerns. That's not the issue here. What I believe the issue is that going on the basic premise that the very purpose of food labeling is to inform and protect the consumer. I don't know, too many people that would argue that. Maybe some would. But I think, you know, we're the ones that are intended to read these food labels. All of us are consumers. The federal government does not always inform and protect us adequately. And I think there's overwhelming evidence to that effect that we will, you know, try to demonstrate today. And when the federal government does not inform or protect us adequately, then states have every right to step forward and do so, you know, for their citizens. And that's basically what this is all about. I just want to address just a few issues that have been brought up, and then, you know, I'd be happy to try to answer any questions, you know, that you may have. And by the way, one, just in terms of the RBGH, you've got some testimony here, or a statement in opposition. The Physicians for Social Responsibility in Oregon, this is around 800 doctors and other professionals. They're totally opposed to this bill, and they have serious concerns about RBGH, too, just in the fact of it's such a danger that they consider a potential danger to human health. So you've got that statement there. Martin Donahoe, the doctor that's taking the lead on this, he had to work and could not be here today to testify. Just a few points. One, to emphasize what Representative Przanski said. I heard the discussion on the House floor on the local aspect of this. And the words came out that, well, if we don't pass this, there's a chance we could have like a crazy quilt. That's a direct quote. Or a checkerboard of local food jurisdictions, whether it's the city or town or county, passing food labeling laws. As near as anybody can find out, and I've talked to a lot of people and done the research myself, Oregon's been a state for 144 years. We can't find any example of a city or county that has passed a food labeling law, nor can we find any evidence whatsoever that any city or county is even considering this. This is just not something that they're really interested in. So we just think that this kind of this vision of this checkerboard is going to interfere with food manufacturers and regulators and all that. We just think this is just so far-fetched that it's just beyond the bounds of reality. Maybe somewhere, sometime, a locality did pass one. We can't find it. Okay? So we just don't even think it's an issue at all. So we think that the main point of this bill, and the main point that has to be addressed, is food labeling at a statewide level.
Rich, you gave, as far as I could see, two or three parts of the equation. First, you gave the part that said nobody's ever done it. No city's ever done it, and no municipality is considering it. Mm-hmm. All right. The third part is: are there any groups that are in, that you know of that are considering
at a local level? At a local level? At a city or county level?
Right.
I can say that I'm very well connected. You know, I worked on Measure 27.
Mm-hmm.
I've continued to volunteer in various groups on this issue. I'm pretty well connected with everybody involved in this issue that's very concerned with genetically engineered foods and these food issues. I've never heard of any locality or anybody, any volunteer group that's trying to get anything going at a local level. You know? So it just, I just don't see it anywhere, and I just think it's something that, it's a fear that, you know, can I say with 100%, you know, guarantee that in the year 2010 some county may consider something? No, I can't say that. But, you know, it just, but in terms of a checkerboard effect or crazy quilt with towns and counties all over the place, no, I just don't see it. It's so far-fetched.
Okay, thank you. Okay. I just wanted to third.
No, that's, no, it's a good point.
Their address.
And just a couple other points here, too. The proponents have brought up, well, this could be overridden. It's a statute. Like any statute, this can be overridden. Well, that's true. But if the Oregon legislature passes this, it's making a statement that they don't believe, you know, that states should have the ability to label more stringently than the federal government on food. This is taking us a step in the wrong direction. It would make it that much more difficult if the Oregon state legislature was on record in that way. It would make it that much more difficult to pass legislation. And let's talk about state action, because if you take a look at the testimony, it isn't just Oregon. It's not just Oregon that's taken action in this area. States all over the country, for all kinds of reasons, okay, for years and years and years, have been passing state food labeling laws. Okay? We're not unique here. They have seen areas where the federal government has just been, you know, just deficient. They don't like what the federal government has done, so they think that they've got to go further. And I keep hearing it characterized as, you know, the states would be trying to bypass or trying to get around what the federal government is doing. It's not bypassing. It's not getting around. It's going further. It's saying that the federal government has not gone far enough, and the states have to step forward. I talked to an official in Ohio, and he just said, you know, look at it. Well, and Ohio's passed a number of laws that go past the federal government. He said, think of it as just there's a wall up there, and there's some holes in the wall, and that the federal government has left. And if we see a hole that we want to fill, we'll do it. And I'm not going to go through it. You can see on the testimony there, the written testimony, all kinds of states have done this. They've had the expertise. You're going to hear in a few minutes where we did. So I don't, this has just been a common practice that many states have felt the need to do.
Rick, let me ask you one thing about that list. You have California listed in two different places, California, Colorado, Florida, Hawaii, et cetera, have food labeling tolerances for food and color additives that are more stringent, I guess, than the federal. Then you have California listed alone, and it has labeling of cancer-causing contaminants, reproductive toxins, and shellfish. Now, would that mean if any cancer-causing contaminant, that there sure is a cancer-causing contaminant in California ends up with a label?
The best of my knowledge, yes. They passed something called Prop 65, I believe,
okay,
back in the 80s.
Of course, there's a huge market. A lot of people would probably make concessions to somebody the size of California, but this RGBH issue that you mentioned earlier is something that hasn't made it onto a label on milk in California, has it?
No. Dairies do it.
I mean, the reason I'm asking this is because you mentioned that you've worked for the Cancer Society for a long time, and so I would assume that you would know if any state has done that.
No, I don't. What states can do or what individual dairies can do, there's one. In fact, we buy their milk from them, Sunshine Dairy in Portland.
Mm-hmm.
They can put a label on saying that this milk does not contain, you know, RBGH in it. They also have to add a statement saying that the FDA has determined that, you know, this RBGH poses no health danger or something to that effect. They have to add that to it, okay? Which, you know, I'm again, I wouldn't certainly not agree with, and many scientists and doctors around the world would not agree with either. But as long as they put that on there, it's okay for them to label it saying it doesn't have it.
Okay.
Sure.
Yes, Senator Byer.
Well, I guess I'd like to get back to your concern and the chair's concern, you know, about whether or not localities are interested or are going to or planning to institute food labeling laws. Well, if what you say is true, that none ever have and none are interested in doing it, and
that I know of, yeah.
No initiatives are being filed by private groups, then why does this concern you?
That part doesn't concern me. That part seems to me a solution in search of a problem. I don't see a problem there because I don't see the cities and counties even being interested. It's the second part that concerns me. It's the saying that states cannot go further than federal government or more stringent in food labeling laws. So it's the second part that concerns me. Okay. Is that just a concern that I have? This is the first I've heard it in a hearing like this about the FDA. Not if the FDA does not address something, the states can do it. There's some question on that, and this has been run by a couple lawyers. Section 2 or subsection 2. It says if a food is subject to a federal requirement for disclosing or displaying information on the label, a state agency may not impose a more stringent labeling requirement. Okay. Be careful on the wording on this because it isn't absolutely clear. This doesn't say if the federal government has a requirement, then the states cannot go further. This says if a food is subject to a federal requirement. There's a difference there. All foods are subject to federal requirements. Now, I talked with a lawyer about this. He couldn't figure it out. He didn't know which way this could be interpreted. But I'm saying there's definitely a question on the interpretation of subsection 2. And I think that needs to be noted. Because you will be hearing testimony here in terms of sulfites and what has happened in Oregon before. Oregon has taken the lead in terms of, you know, going ahead of the federal government, becoming more stringent. So I just wanted to say something about that. Okay. I don't want to take too much time. But again, other states have done this. You're going to hear testimony where Oregon has taken the lead. And I think it's very important to note that the federal government often is late or comes in later than maybe we'd like on bills, on passing legislation, and that it's the states that have taken the lead. And because the states have taken the lead and enacted their own bills, their own laws, then the federal government takes what the states have learned and writes it into a federal law. And that's exactly what happened with the organic law, which we'll get to.
Okay.
Final statements. I would definitely acknowledge the concerns of the proponents of the bill, and I think they have every right that, you know, it's in terms of oftentimes consistency is a good thing, just have one thing on a label, and absolutely nothing wrong with minimizing costs, for any business to do that. I was responsible for payroll for many years. I would do everything I could in a nonprofit arena to minimize costs. My wife is involved in a small business. She minimizes costs. So there's certainly understandable considerations that have to be, considered on any kind of food labeling. But what we're saying is, first and foremost, it's the rights of the consumer to know what is in the food that they're eating. Okay? That is the purpose of food labeling, and that has to be considered, above anything else. All these things should be considered, but that is what we're addressing here, and that is what we don't think this bill, we think this bill goes in the absolute wrong direction of the consumer's right to know.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it, Rich. Kate Miller.
Hi. You have a copy.
Can you identify yourself?
Oh, sorry, Kate Miller. For the record, I just wanted to come and testify to add to a little bit of what Rick has touched on so far by stating a specific example of how sometimes federal food labeling laws are not enacted necessarily to protect and inform the consumers, but are influenced by power politics. This specific example relates to irradiated foods, specifically irradiated meat products. This all started in 1997 with the urging and sizable contributions from the meat industry, special interest groups. And this is when Senator McConnell from Kentucky, Senator Jeffords from Vermont, and Representative Gangsky from Iowa took the lead in passing the FDA Modernization Act. This weakened the labeling requirements for irradiated foods. These actually even changed the label and required them to be no longer than the ingredient list. This continued in 2002 when Senator Tom Harkin from Iowa, he inserted a last-minute rider on the farm bill, and this changed labeling from irradiated to pastures to the label pasteurized. I don't think it's a coincidence that Senator Harkin's home state of Iowa had the largest food irradiating facility in the United States. Just in general, irradiation basically is used as a cheap fix for fecal contamination in meat, generally due to speeded up slaughter in slaughterhouses, decreased federal inspection, just poor conditions, contamination, and such. It would make sense to me that we would improve these conditions rather than dousing our food with radiation. And the kicker is that consumers have over and over again stated their disagreement with this. I have listed several polls here. CBS News found 73% of the public opposed to irradiation. 77% of consumers did not even want to eat it. In 99, a poll from the American Association of Retired Persons and the Center for Science and Public Interest found 88.6% of Americans wanted the labeling of irradiated foods. 1999 again, the FDA, this is when the FDA first proposed watering down the labeling of irradiated food. 30,000 comments came in, 99% of them were in favor of putting a label on irradiated food, a specific label on it that told the truth. And some of these even opposed irradiation altogether. 2000, 38% of shoppers in a Food Marketing Institute poll said they'd buy irradiated food. This is down from 60% in 1998. So basically, this is just one example. The bottom line is that obviously, calling irradiated food pasteurized is not informing the public. It's not protecting their safety. It's, in fact, deceiving them. And this is, as a consumer, is outraging. I'm outraged. And, you know, when the federal government acts in this manner, this is an example when states need to step forward and preserve their authority to clarify and supplement food federal food labeling. So please vote no on HB 2957.
Did you have your testimony written?
I'm sorry. I turned it in before Rick, so you have it.
I don't see it in my stack, so it's right here. Okay. Somehow I got left out of the loop. Thank you very much. Any questions? Okay, I appreciate both of you coming and sharing this morning.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
And we'll go back to the other side now. Dirk Davis and Steve. He wrote faster than I can read.
Slow enough, sir.
How'd you say that?
Lowendorf.
Thank you, Steve. Dirk, go ahead.
Then I will. Good morning, gentlemen. Mr. Chairman, my name is Dirk Davis. I am the president of Unified Western Grocers. We are a co-op distributor located in Milwaukee, Oregon. We represent about 425 local grocery stores that employ over 10,000 people in the state of Oregon and Washington and California. We have about 450 employees, Teamster employees, in our facility in Milwaukee. We have another 225 in our warehouse as well, or in our administration building. From a distribution standpoint, there are some real challenges to this bill if it was passed, if it was not passed. The product assortment, and Senator Corcoran gave a very good example. If we bought from Kellogg's and we buy on a national basis, if we have to bring a product into our facility that has a separate label to go either to different counties or to different, even just a different state, there are many manufacturers that will not sell to us. So the variety of product that we will have for our stores will be diminished. If the variety is diminished, then our competitive advantage as an independent is also diminished. If we were subject to this law, then we would have to add specific slots in our warehouse. Currently, we have over 25,000 different slots in our warehouse today for our items. We would have to duplicate that. Frankly, I don't have the space nor the cost containment to do such an endeavor. The additional transportation costs in going to different areas within the state, again, I would have to have additional costs, which would most likely lead to me reducing the number of truckers that I have and distribution workers. I would also state 2 points of clarification from prior testimony. It's my knowledge, I don't have all the facts, but that an initiative was filed in 2000 in Portland, I believe by the group that supported Measure 27, to put in local labeling laws. I believe that they did not gather enough signatures for that initiative to go to ballot. So to say that nobody has in the 144 years of the state, or that they won't, I don't believe that's true. I believe that we have already seen that once and that we will see it again. That's all I have. If I can answer any questions.
I had a question. You were talking about buying from Kellogg. Mm-hmm. And I see the problem. What do you think about this issue of changing the name from pasteurization to from irradiation to pasteurization? I mean, I've been drinking pasteurized milk probably for 50 years. How long has meat been irradiated?
I'm not an expert in that, sir. I'm not sure.
Do you follow my logic? I mean, the word, I don't think those two words are interchangeable. And so it raises issues for me about labeling.
Correct. I would tell you, too, on the RBST, there are many dairies and many stores in the state of Oregon that do carry RBST-free milk. It is on the label today.
Thank you.
So the consumer is not unaware of the product and what is in the product. We get a lot of calls for what is inside the product. So if a consumer has an interest in what is in their product that they are purchasing, before they make that decision at shelf level, there's always a number on that product that they can call and get details from that manufacturer.
Okay, so let me see if I can get this straight. You say that several milk, it's milk, is it? And what's the
RBST free?
RBST free.
I believe it's the same growth hormone that Mr. North was talking about.
Okay.
Umpqua Dairies, large dairy in the state, Mallory's Dairy,
okay,
both have RBST-free products.
Now, with that label that says that it's RBST-free, would that be affected by the bill if it says that, does that have anything to do with a labeling requirement more stringent than the federal requirement?
Well, Mr. Chairman, how I'd answer that is that those are both Oregon companies. So within the state of Oregon, they don't have any issues. But if they chose to send that product outside, then they could have issues. So, and again, with this labeling law, whether you have it within a local jurisdiction, a local district, or statewide, it's the same problem. You are going to prohibit local manufacturers from exporting product outside of Oregon. So,
okay, thank you. Let's see, I got your first name, Steve.
For the record, my name is Steve Lowendorf, and I'm Technical Director for Research Fine Foods up in Beaverton, Oregon.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you very much for this opportunity to share with you Research Fine Foods' viewpoint and support for the proposed House Bill 2957 and the benefits that we believe it will bring to our company and to other food processors doing business in the state. First, however, some background about Research Fine Foods may be in order. Research was founded in 1950 by Earl and Mildred Reeser, the parents of our current president. They began by marketing a single potato salad that was Mildred's fine recipe, and we still produce that exact recipe today, 53 years later, along with 68 other varieties of potato salad. The company grew into a full-line regional salad company, and under Al's leadership, expanded into meats, Mexican foods, refrigerated salsas, sauces and potatoes, and numerous other food categories. We currently operate 12 food manufacturing plants in 7 states, including North Carolina, Ohio, Kansas, Utah, Washington, Hawaii, and of course, Oregon. We employ about 2,000 people today, and because our corporate headquarters are in Beaverton, about 500 of us are located there. With our nationwide presence, the existence of localized food labeling regulations that would supersede or be different from established federal regulations would be nightmarish, and that's why we are very much in support of House Bill 2957. I checked yesterday, and we use 3,400 different labels on the variety of products that we manufacture, 3,400. And we also distribute a large number of what's called co-packed items, which are made by other manufacturers but packed under the Reeser label. We are very aware that labeling problems are currently the major reason for food recalls in the U.S., so our labeling practices command a lot of attention in our organization. Our meat-containing products are labeled subject to the United States Department of Agriculture, and all of our labels have to be approved by them, and all of the other products must meet the standards of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. We are committed to complete, accurate, truthful, and fully compliant labeling on all of our products, so any proposed changes in food regulations gets our attention quickly. The concept of local jurisdictions passing labeling laws that change or take precedent over established USDA or FDA labeling regulations to us is very troubling. We manufacture many items in multiple plants, and we share the labels between them along with the ingredients interchangeably. One of our key competencies as a company is that we can supply our products to our customers from any region, from any of our plants, with a seamless supply chain management situation. This is important to national customers that we have that you would recognize, people like Kentucky Fried Chicken, Boston Markets, TGIF restaurants, even Walmart. A proliferation of localized labeling laws would prevent this. We struggle mightily with how we could cope with and how we could afford to do anything other than nutritional national labeling standards. Just the printing plate charges for label modifications, and again I checked yesterday, are $90. And remember, we have 3,400 different labels. Designing and managing labeling changes from the packaging suppliers through our plants and into distribution would add additional layers of expense. Another concern for us would be how to get correctly labeled but differently labeled product into the right local jurisdiction. We utilize a computerized shipping and tracking system called PKMS, which uses barcodes to control distribution, but it's not capable of pinpointing specific geographical regions such as specific counties or municipalities. The technology exists for this, of course, but again, the expense is a significant concern. A PKMS system requires a specific barcode and corresponding UPC for every variation of a product. so that if you have a different type of product, even if it's just a minor different label, you have to have a different UPC, a different barcode, and a different specific area in the warehouse to store it, a different pallet space or different pallet spaces. If you were able to see our warehouses today, you'd see how full they are, and to proliferate other variations of labels for the same product would just kill us and crowd us out. We worry about staying competitive in our markets if House Bill 2957 does not pass. Purchasing decisions in our industry are often made on differences in pennies or even fractions of pennies. Local labeling requirements would leave us no option but to pass on our increased costs to our customers and ultimately on to the consumer. If competitors in other regions were not subjected to the same regulations, we would surely lose business. Now, we're already planning for the next anticipated round of federal labeling changes. Those are going to be requiring the declaration of trans fats and cool or country of origin labeling. We're watching our label inventories and planning label designs already, even though these regulations will not be fully implemented, we think, until probably 2 years. But the ability to plan ahead and minimize our financial impact on label changes is a good thing about dealing with what we consider kind of a rather sluggish federal requirement. The more nimble local jurisdictions could enact requirements much more quickly and probably cost us a lot more money, and that's a big concern to us. We deal almost constantly with the labeling regulators in both the USDA and the FDA. In fact, I was just in meetings with both of them 2 weeks ago in Chicago. And while they're slow and bureaucratic and cumbersome to deal with, their predictability for us is good. And they do have a record of eventually getting things right. Sound science eventually prevails, and the all sides of an issue are heard and given fair consideration. We believe that the public is adequately protected and informed within the confines of the existing federal system. But we do respect the concerns of individuals and groups who do have the right to know what they're eating and who question what's in their foods. Researchers will always make sure that these questions and concerns are addressed, and we feel the best forum for doing that is through our very responsive customer service organization. We handle customer inquiries many every day, often going beyond the existing federal labeling requirements, and we handle them effectively by mail, by phone, by fax, and email increasingly many times each day. This to us is a much more effective method of trying to satisfy what otherwise would be many additional labeling requirements there could be. So in summary, we support House Bill 2957. We think it's good for our company, our employees, the Oregon food processing industry, and the Oregon citizens and consumers. We hope it'll have your support as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'd like to interrupt for just a second here and welcome several 8th grade students from Westland Middle School in Corvallis who have just come in. What we're doing right now is a hearing on House Bill 2957A has to do with food labeling. And you've just heard testimony from Reser Fine Food Corporation. So I just wanted to welcome you young people here. We have some questions now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for participating down at OSU.
Thank you.
My question would be, and someone implied that this bill would make it so that this is the only requirement, but is there anything that would prohibit a company from putting additional information on their label if they so chose with this bill?
The only thing I am aware of that you can't say is things like does not contain BST or the growth hormone that we're talking about, because that makes by implication anything that doesn't have that labeling sort of guilty by not having it. So there are a few things that you can't say on a label, yes, but
if you wanted, likewise, you heard the comment about irradiation, mm-hmm. and the word being replaced with pasteurization. Can you still use the word irradiation if
yes,
you want?
Absolutely. And there's a Radura symbol that certainly researchers would want to put on any product. We don't irradiate anything anyway, but if we ever considered that, we would want that clearly known and easy and visible.
So in your corporation, if you had anything that was irradiated, you would want irradiated rather than pasteurized?
Irradiated and with the Radura symbol that's there, yes, just to make it very clear.
Yeah, so that... I'm glad to hear that. That's good.
Mr. Chair,
yeah.
Another question. And Joe Gilliam handed us these chips, and what exactly is the label? Because I see on these chips it says made with no genetically engineered ingredients on the front of the package. Is that part of the label, or is just the label this part back here?
Well, they're all part of labeling, but the required elements of the label are what's called the principal display panel, which is the back section that you're referring to.
Okay, so, and because, I mean, I don't think, are they required to put no genetically engineered ingredients on it? So that's something that's been added because this company markets, obviously, to a consumer.
Because they think that's a good thing.
Senator Beyer, you hit the word right, and that's marketing. So you have the ability to inform the consumer of what you want them to know.
So in a real sense, this is marketing, and this is labeling.
That's science, right?
Correct.
This is TV, and this is science. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay.
So as long as there's nothing factually inaccurate here, it's okay.
Correct.
That's interesting. Okay. Are there other questions? Well, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you
for your time.
Appreciate it. We have to make a correction for the record, and so we're going to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I do want to point out that there is one, I would say, even though it's a word, it's an important difference in the effective dates of the dash A2s as compared to the dash A3s that Senator Beyer was asking about before. Under the dash A2s, it applies to adoption of food label requirements on or after the effective date of the Act. Under the dash A3s, it also includes existing before on or after the effective date. So, for example, if there was, I know we heard testimony to the contrary, but if there was a local requirement for a food label information under the dash A2s, that would be able to continue. Under the dash A3s, that would have to be repealed.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We've had pro and con, and more pro. We'll have more statements again, but I'm going to hustle. Let's go with two more no's since we've had two yeses, and that would be, it looks like, Lori Hellman and Mel Banks.
Thank you.
Huh?
Thanks.
Sorry about that.
That's okay.
I'm not all that good at reading people's handwriting.
Lori Heilman. I'm with First Alternative Foods Co-op in Corvallis. And I'm delighted to see some of my daughter's Wesleyan Middle School friends walking in the room. A complete surprise. Very nice. First Alternative is a consumer-owned food cooperative. We've been in business for 33 years now in Corvallis. It was started at a very grassroots level by a group of town and gown people from OSU and also residents of the community. Started out as a buying club and has grown into what this year we expect to be a $9 million retail business. I don't have any written testimony. My apologies for that. If you're looking through your papers for something from me.
How big a co-op have you got?
Pardon me?
How big a co-op is that?
$9 million in sales this year. We're on Thursday opening our second store. So our original store, the main store, is now about 7,000 square feet of retail space, and the second store will bring us an additional 4,000 square feet of retail. We currently have over 4,000 member owners representing at least 4,000 households in Corvallis, which, as you probably know, is a town of about 50,000. So we have a sizable segment of the foods market in Corvallis. Mm-hmm. And in the midst of the current recession, mini-recession, however you want to phrase it, we actually last year, after an expansion of our existing store, have experienced a 25% growth rate, and we expect to have an 11-12% growth rate this year. So we are thriving. People want what we have to offer, and they like the way that we do business. And fundamental to the way that we do business is that we are owned by consumers, so we do what our owners want. And we are very sensitive to consumer preference in our practices in the store and in the goods and services that we offer. to our owners and to the larger community. You don't have to be a co-op owner in order to shop there, and we do have a significant percentage of people who have not purchased owner shares but who still come to First Alternative for their food. So from that grassroots beginning through this whole cooperative structure, what we have found is that our customers, the consumers in Corvallis who patronize our business, they want information. They want it very badly. They want to know what is in their food, and they're highly aware of the impact of different ingredients on their personal health. And in our case, our particular set of customers are very concerned about the impact of food production methods on the environment as well, and also food production methods on the impact of farm worker health and other related issues. So they see food production, food consumption as really very integral to not only their own personal health, but values that they hold dear in relation to the outside world as well. And just as one example, decades ago, our owners wanted to know where their produce was grown. They had many, many reasons for wanting to know that. For some of them, it was very important to support local growers. They only wanted to buy food that was grown, if not in Oregon, at least in the northwest region of the United States. And they couldn't know that unless we provided the information on our in-store labels. So we started doing that. Others had other reasons for wanting to know where food was coming from. There was concern about pesticide drift on food that was grown in Mexico, for example. As you know, the United States has banned the use of certain pesticides and herbicides in food production here, but other countries continue to use them, and our folks were concerned about that and so wanted to be able to make that choice for themselves. Couldn't do so unless we provided them the information. Point of origin is now becoming federal law, and I'm proud to say that not only First Alternative Co-op, but other consumer-owned cooperatives across the country were there first, and we made it happen. Now, that is one example of where we were able to provide information to our consumers because we had the information. Our consumers currently are extremely concerned about genetically modified organisms, and it was brought up very early in testimony here that, in fact, the intent of this bill is to restrict the labeling of genetically modified organisms, at least as a single state. For several years now, as awareness of the potential impacts of GMOs on human health and on the environment has increased, our consumers have been asking us for that information. We would love to be able to give it to them, but as retailers, we are at the end of the line of information, and there is absolutely no way that we can tell them whether a food has genetically modified organisms in it or not, because we don't get that information. Manufacturers are not required to label the wholesale units that they sell to us. Growers are not required to label the raw materials that they send to the manufacturers. At no point along that chain is that information documented and then passed along. When it comes to the general idea of labeling GMOs, I deeply, deeply sympathize with the manufacturers who have testified in favor of this bill previously. I really do. I understand their fear and concern about increasing costs. I understand the resistance to increased regulation and to the paperwork that goes along with it. I have to say, from my position as a representative of consumers in Corvallis, that I think that the attention needs to shift away from restricting consumers' rights to know onto those corporations that are marketing the ingredients that consumers are concerned about. Measure 27, as we all know, the proponents of Measure 27 were outspent, what was it, 200-1 in this state. And the most of the $5.5-6 million that came into Oregon to defeat Measure 27 came in from out-of-state concerns, primarily the biotechnology companies that are producing the GMO products that Measure 27 would have addressed. I've heard many people, not just in previous testimony here, but during the Measure 27 campaign, say, I don't object to labeling, but it's got to happen on the federal level. It can't happen on the state level. We've tried. We have tried on the federal level for years now. We have tried. And as a number of years ago, 500,000 letters poured into the USDA in objection to, in support of a federal labeling law for GMOs. Why hasn't it happened? Well, call me cynical, but I would have to say that those same biotechnology giants who came into Oregon with their $6 million probably had a lot of influence over stalling that legislation at a federal level. I just don't see it happening. And I see Oregon as a place that has a history of being activist when it comes to consumer rights, when it comes to setting the pace for the rest of the country. And I would really hate to see HB 2957 put a stop to that in the case of the opportunity to label GMOs in our food. Thank you.
And GMO labeling, you just gave that story about Washington. What's happened in other countries? Is GMO labeling occurring in other places?
Yes, it exists in Japan. It exists in Australia. It exists in a number of European countries. And there are countries, in fact, that have banned the use of certain GMO products outright.
If that happened, and I'm thinking about, you know, multinational corporations and so on, they had the same money in Europe or Australia or Japan that they have here to fight it. Why did it happen?
It consumer preference and governmental sympathy to consumers.
Okay. Senator Buck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Unless I don't understand this bill, I don't see anything in this bill that would keep your store and your co-op from labeling foods how you see fit. And your story seems you are thriving in your community. Your community wants the information, but this bill and this law would not prohibit you from giving that information to your consumers.
No, the point being that we don't have the information. There's no way as retailers that we can get the information about GMO ingredients in food that's been manufactured farther down the line.
But, Mr. Chair, I guess my point would be that you are free and your consumers are free to choose to use a product or not. So if you can't get the information for a product, there's nothing in this bill or in the law that says you have to continue to offer that product. And as the gentleman from research indicated, the manufacturers are very customer-oriented, and if there's a human cry to get that information or their product's not going to be used anymore, information will be there, and this bill doesn't prohibit you from asking for that information and choosing not to carry a product if they don't provide it.
Research has a lot of integrity, and I admire their position on that. I don't know that I would extend that to every manufacturer.
Following up on Senator Meyer's question, you are simply as a cooperative with 4,000 members and a $9 million business going, wanting to get information because your customers want it.
Correct.
Now, you're saying that there are companies that are so big, so national or multinational, or that there are manufacturers, maybe not the distribution, but the manufacturers are so big that they can just say, we don't care about these 4,000 here and 20,000 maybe in Portland and 50,000 in L.A. that are demanding this, because we're selling to this 280 million member country, and we're not going to change for the little folks. Is that the way you would typify it?
Yes, I would say so. Now, it's interesting to note that the multinational manufacturers that are based here in our country do, of course, sell to Japan and to Australia and to those European nations that have labeling laws currently. And just a few months ago, I became aware of an instance with Kraft Manufacturing Company, and one of their products that they manufacture is a packaged pre-cooked macaroni and cheese. Contained in the cheese is the possibility, at least, of RBGH, and there is certainly the possibility of other GE products in there, from corn strips that they might use or soy additives that they might use. They manufacture this product and they ship it to the United States, to outlets in the United States, and it does not have any indication of potential GE content in it. They manufacture that very same product in the very same facility, and they ship it to Australia, and it has labeling according to Australian law. That product sells in Australia for precisely the same price that it sells for in the United States, and that's after shipping it to the other side of the world. It's possible to do.
That's a fascinating story. I'm sorry you don't have that written testimony. I need to keep that in my brain.
I guess I'd have to go back to this. Here we have a potato, or actually a tortilla chip, that it says no genetically engineered ingredients. So alternatives exist for you and your customers, even without required labeling, correct?
Alternatives do exist for our customers who take it upon themselves to become very well informed. I think that you probably would admit, I don't remember if you were in the room for Mr. North's testimony, but he is a person who makes it a point to be very well informed about what he's consuming. And it wasn't until he really put a lot of time and attention on researching recombinant bovine growth hormone that he discovered the potential link to cancer. People who are very intelligent still have to go way out of their way to get the information. And I don't believe that that's how labels should function. I don't think that you should have to work that hard to get information that could potentially be useful in the maintenance of your own personal health.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I'm beginning to look at the clock here and realize that we're running short of time. So I'm going to give you a few minutes to go ahead, and I'm going to try and speed this process up. By the way, we've got more students from Corvallis. I think lots of Corvallis students have showed up this morning. So we're glad that you're here.
Go Ducks!
Now, students. Oh, nice. Nice move,
I'm
Senator.
Senator Duck. I got to say that.
And there's no relationship.
We're not a football school. And apparently we're not a basketball school.
There's no relationship between that and a bunch of students walking out.
That's
I want to thank the rest of the students from Corvallis for coming this morning. And what we are discussing is a food labeling bill, what you can read on the label of the foods in your store. And I want to thank you, and let's let the next witness go here.
Thank you, Chairman and committee. My name is Mel Bancroft, and I am from the home of granola, Eugene, Oregon, and been the president of Emerald Valley Kitchen for the last 19 years, and recently we merged with a company down in California, Monterey Pasta. And I have grave concerns about House Bill 2957. I believe that House Bill 2957 is a draconian law that threatens our state's freedoms to exercise both its initiative and legislative processes in regard to food labeling. This law makes it impossible And now I realize a little further, it doesn't make it impossible, it makes it more difficult for people to exercise their democratic freedoms to have any say in what goes into the food. It does, however, protect the corporation's influence over the FDA and USDA. I feel increasingly uncomfortable both as a citizen and as a food manufacturer because of the swinging door policy between corporations and the FDA and the USDA. For example, Ann Veneman, who is the head of the FDA, was an employee of Monsanto, which is the largest producer of genetically engineered materials. So,
and he's now the head of the FDA.
She is. Yeah.
So you go from working for Monsanto to being the head of the FDA.
And that's been a practice for quite a number of years. There's been quite a few people who have been part of Monsanto and have become part of the FDA. And their justification there is that they're the ones that have the best knowledge and information about the products, so it only deems it appropriate for them to be in that position. Let's see. So I feel like because of these situations of political influence, it sort of threatens the integrity of the decision-making process of these agencies. With the downsizing of federal government, it is even more important for states to assert a greater level of responsibility in safeguarding our food. Oregon presently has the ability to legislate its own labeling laws. So why do we choose to abdicate our authority to the federal agencies? I believe in the state's power to utilize its authority to inform, educate, safeguard its citizens. Oregon's ability to function independently of the FDA, USDA creates the opportunity for new marketing niches for Oregon-made products. As an example, is the organic movement. Oregon wrote its first organic laws in the 1970s, which became federal law in 2002. Emerald Valley Kitchen, along with lots of other companies, have experienced lots of success in this growing market niche. This is truly a success story in which Oregon played an integral role in being a leader in the country, changing a law from a state level to a federal level. This demonstrates how a state can support educate the federal government for the common good of its citizens. HB 2957 makes the false assumption that there needs to be a preemptive law because of the burdensome financial impact of state labeling laws. And I just want to sort of say that I found it interesting with ballot measure 27 that we tried to get passed in November. One of the major shifts that created the change in the citizens of the state was when the information came out that it was going to cost the consumers the families $500 a year or more by the research that was promoted by our opposition. And it was unfortunate because it was late in the game. We got information from an independent study that was done by a professor at the University of Oregon, economics professor, also working with the USDA, came out and said that the information that was being promoted to the Oregon citizens was probably 45 times higher, not 45%, 45 times higher than what the reality was from all the research that he was able to do in the European Union and other places in the world that had existing labeling laws and what the costs were for the manufacturer. And an example of that one is back in 1973 was one example of the Oregon law requiring that the expiration date be printed on on our products. And as a manufacturer, that was a that for us is sort of like a no-cost issue, you know, and it creates the opportunity for doing better quality control and giving consumers a lot, you know, better choice in getting the freshest food off the shelf. So you always go behind the product that's in front and make sure you get to the one behind it, so because you know it's going to be fresher. HB 2957, I guess these are just a couple of examples that demonstrate that we must not throw out the baby with the bathwater. I trust the checks and balances of our state and local governments to stop laws that are unnecessary, that promote self-interest, or lack pertinent consumer information. Proposals arise from the legislature and initiative process that have merit and can succeed and hopefully increase consumer awareness that could create new markets for Oregon products. Let us not thwart the democratic process by legislating away our rights at the local level. And you keep lifting up that container, that bag of chips. I want to say something about that bag of chips. Where it says no genetically engineered materials, that right now is being challenged by the federal government because they feel like that is a falsification. And the reason it's a falsification is because that they can't, that the manufacturers, whoever makes that product, can't assure that there truly are no genetically engineered ingredients in there, because a product like corn, which open pollinates, has no boundary. There's no boundaries on it. So we've seen with the Starlink issue was an example of how the food industry got so totally inundated with genetically engineered materials, and so the federal government right now will be making it more difficult for manufacturers to say no and no GMOs on their bags. I just feel like, once again, for Oregon to be in a lead position, whether it be GMO or what other impacts there might be down the road in the future around food and food safety, it's so important for us to be able to have greater strength in our state and local policies to implement food guidelines that can exceed what the feds are able or willing to do.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? If not, I'm going to ask you folks to step back. And I'm going to call Gary Conkling. He's on the list here. Ask him if he'll come up. I know that he has
Representative Johnson back there.
And Representative Johnson has just wandered in the room. Are you wanting to speak in this bill too?
No, thanks.
It has nothing to do with airplanes, Representative.
Well, then I'll
Gary, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Gary Conkling, here today representing the Oregon Wine Growers Association, which has no objection to House Bill 2957. But we do have a small issue that relates to our own product. In Oregon, labeling for wine is a delegated responsibility to the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. And in the 1970s, many of the founders of Oregon's wine industry, as a strategic consideration, have agreed to, and in fact the OLCC imposes, labeling requirements that are stricter than would be required under federal regulation. And I've listed in my written testimony three of the areas where that's so, involving appellation. Under Oregon's rules, 100% of the wine contained must be from grapes grown within the state appellation of origin, such as the Willamette Valley or what have you. Under federal standards, as much as 25% can come from another origin. Varietal contents, under Oregon rules, 90% of the wine contained must be the variety stated on the label, with very, very few exceptions. Under federal standards, it's only 75%. And in grape variety names, we We have a much shorter list. This was intended as a really a point of focus. It's really a market consideration. The list is longer at the federal level, and from time to time, by rule, the Oregon Liquor Control Commission expands that when there is some new variety that seems to be dominated. So we have put forward what is, I think, the A4 amendment. It's a simple exclusion for us from the part two of the state regulation. Again, it's not intended to be a mischief to the bill. It's just a simple recognition that we have by our own hand regulations that are stricter than the federal ones, and would appreciate if you move the bill to include our amendment.
Thank you, Gary. Are there any questions? Thank you for the explanation. Yep. We're getting late. I have four more people. We've got two for Ken Yates and Gene Wilkinson. Could you both come forward and give us brief testimony, if possible? Sorry to file up your cell phone attempt there.
I locked my keys in my car, so
we'll only keep you a moment.
With the amount of car clouts that are going on now, somebody will probably have it open for you by the time you go out there.
I didn't get the chance to know where I was.
Mr. Chairman, Ken Yates, Vice President of Government Affairs for the Northwest Food Processors Association. I'm staff for the Oregon Food Processors Council. You've heard from a couple food processors today on this bill. I will be brief. We support House Bill 2957 because local governments do not have the financial or technical resources to promulgate rational food labeling regulations. The Federal Food and Drug Administration, the United States Department of Agriculture, have competently fulfilled that mission for many, many decades. Local governments could spend a great deal of money trying to justify and enforce programs that are duplicative, scientifically inferior, and misleading potentially to consumers. Oregon food processors cannot afford a conflicting and overlapping set of labeling requirements among local jurisdictions. Distribution systems require economic rationality and therefore uniformity in order to function. Let's not balkanize Oregon's food distribution system. I want to make this point also. House Bill 2959 does not impact consumer choice in local communities. For example, individuals anywhere in the state of Oregon can purchase non-genetically engineered products under USDA's National Organic Program that was adopted in December of 2000. Was then adopted by the state of Oregon in legislation during the 2001 session. Oregonians can purchase products labeled as grown in Oregon. As was distinguished in earlier testimony, there is marketing labeling, and then there is required labeling, and we have a system that works. Over 90% of Oregon food manufactured products are exported from this state. If local jurisdictions in this state enact costly and onerous labeling requirements, it will be simply more cost-effective to abandon that market and not sell there, thereby limiting consumer choices. I think it's also very important in conclusion, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that House Bill 2957 still allows the state of Oregon to promulgate labeling requirements where there is no federal requirement. There's nothing to prevent any of the groups that have spoken in opposition to this legislation from running a son or daughter of Measure 27 in the state under this bill. And I think that's important to understand. So there is that flexibility, at the same time maintaining some semblance of uniformity so we can function and try to succeed economically in this state. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll conclude and entertain any questions you may have.
Are there any questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I have to take issue, Ken, with your comment about the federal government being the do-all and be-all of this, and local governments, I assume you mean the state of Oregon as well, being incompetent in, what does your statement say, don't have the financial or technical resources to promulgate rational food labeling rules. We just heard testimony from the wine industry asking to be accepted from this because they do, in fact, for marketing purposes, have rules promulgated by OLCC that obviously are very important to their marketing, or they wouldn't, you know, they wouldn't be asking for the exception. And the other thing that I find really ironic in your comment is that the development in Oregon, it happens to be a constituent, an old friend of mine, was involved in the development of the organic Oregon, I can't remember the name of the Oregon Organic Foods Act in 1989, and that became the model for the federal plan. So, you know, we shouldn't overstate the, you know, there's a fight that's going on here, and that's fine, but I think for the record we should be a little more careful about saying what local governments can or can't have the capacity to do.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Corcoran, I think in these distressed economic and budgetary times for local governments, that was the intended context of that comment. This is just simply an area that we can't afford to get into right now, was the thrust of my comment, certainly its intention. You know, right now we have agencies at the federal level that are doing this very competently and very scientifically, and there's a reason for that. And it's to preserve consumer choices, accurate and scientifically justified information, and uniformity for processors and retailers of food products. But thank you.
Your turn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Jean Underhill Wilkinson, representing the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. You've heard a lot of good testimony today and a lot of good debate on this issue, and so I'm not going to reiterate some of those points that you've heard today, so my testimony will be brief. It's probably no surprise that we do support House Bill 2957A. I just want to make a couple of points. Farmers in this state and this nation, as you probably all know, are having a difficult time financially, economically, for many different reasons, but part of those reasons is the amount of regulations that we as a farming community have to comply with. Now, I'm not going to make judgments about the necessity of those regulations, but they are there, and they come with a cost, and the farming community has to absorb those costs. In other countries, as you probably know as well, the regulations aren't quite on the same level as they are here in the United States, and so already, before we even begin distributing our food products in the food chain, we are at a competitive disadvantage because we have a hard time dealing and competing on a price range with food products coming in from other countries. So with food labeling, I think it needs to be treated very carefully because it can impose additional costs and can impede the free flow of commerce and food products in this nation. Also, there is no food product grown in Oregon that isn't grown on a larger scale somewhere else in the nation. Oregon is a relatively small agriculture industry, although it's very, very important to the economics of the state. There is very few things in Oregon that are specifically unique when it comes to agriculture compared with other places in the nation. So food labeling, as far as we're concerned, needs to be done carefully and on a uniform basis with scientific research, much debate, and public review before these decisions are made that can impact the industry. And we feel that on this particular issue, even though we are strong believers in local control and the decisions made by the state of Oregon, on this particular issue, because of its importance and potential magnitude of treatment in the agriculture industry, we feel it's most appropriate venue and forum to be dealt with on a federal basis versus more of a local jurisdiction. For these reasons, we support House Bill 2957A. Thank you.
Any questions? Jean, a question just popped in my head, and I just have to ask this. Recently, I heard a comment that Tiger Woods picture on the front of a Wheaties box, that Tiger Woods was paid more for his picture on the box than the farmer was paid for the wheat that went into the Wheaties. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I'm certain that that's true.
And what I was wondering,
farmers hit some pretty good forearms, Mr. Chair.
Well, I don't know if that's relevant to my point, but I was wondering if you'd like a label.
That's right.
Here's my point. I was wondering if you'd like a label that would say that the guy with the picture got so much of the percentage of that sale, and the processors got so much, and the cardboard manufacturers got so much, and the guys that made the wheat are at the bottom. You know, would you like a label like that on the box? It's just an interesting...
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm sure that would be interesting for people to know and probably surprising facts for people to know.
That question drove these kids out of here.
Not surprising.
Not surprising. Well, it is interesting to
yes.
me that this kind of thing goes on. Well, thank you. I guess
thank
there's
you.
No questions. We'll let you step back. There's only two people left. Ron McKay from the Oregon Department of Agriculture was on the list.
I put him on the list.
Oh, you put him on the list.
I asked.
Okay. And the other person is Maureen Kirk from Osberg, if she's still here. And we're going to just hurry through and... Yes, if there's anything you can say that hasn't already been said, say it quickly. I called you first, Ron. Do you want to say anything?
Senator Shields, members of the committee, my name is Ron McKay. I am the administrator of the Food Safety Division of the Oregon Department of Agriculture. And I'm assuming that Senator Beyer had some questions.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just informed that you could clarify the Section 2 of the bill, that this is actually the way that ODA would like to see it in order for it uniform.
Senator Shields,
it's
Senator
not Section 2, it's Sub 2 of Section A,
yes.
Or Section 1,
yes.
Sub 2. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. The review that we've done on it, yes, sir, we are comfortable with the language that's in Section 2. Excuse me, Part 2 of Section 1.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So that means that, are you making the assumption then that that can create restrictions? On a statewide basis, then, for the state government? You're comfortable with that?
Chairman Shields, Senator Corcoran, I'm not sure I understand your question.
My question is, are you comfortable with the fact that that particular language places a restriction on state government with regards to the Department of Agriculture doing anything with this kind of labeling?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Corcoran, as I understand it, and we have not got legal interpretations on this, this would allow the state of Oregon to write regulations or to put regulations in effect if federal standards don't exist. The only time it would restrict us from doing anything at the state level is if there were specific federal standards in place already. Then we could not go beyond them.
Okay.
And you're comfortable with that?
Yes, sir, we are.
What about the list of states that was in testimony earlier that are already more strict, you know, other states? Did you see that list that was provided?
Yeah, maybe their manufacturers will come our way.
Well, there was a list: Florida, California, Illinois, Pennsylvania, Iowa, could have. Did you see this or didn't you?
Mr. Chairman, no, sir, I did not see it. Oregon has also had regulations which have gone beyond federal regulations in the past, such as the open dating law, such as the organic foods bill that was mentioned earlier, other things that have gone beyond that when no federal regulations were in place. And if I interpret this correctly, this is just states going beyond where there apparently are no federal regulations on this. But I'm not completely familiar with everything that's in it.
Okay. The other question I would have was the question, which is kind of a, what would a lawyer say when he's looking at the statement, if a food is subject to a federal requirement? It's not saying that it has one, but is subject to, and there's some unclear, it's not clear what that phrase means.
Yes. Chairman Shields, I do agree with you. I am not sure what a lawyer would say. As that question was posed earlier and I read that, the next few words, for disclosing or displaying information on the label, every food that is in the retail store that is offered for sale is required to be labeled. Then the federal laws, in some cases state laws, go beyond that and say, in addition to the general labeling provisions, we also have additional requirements. And possibly it's referring to those, but again, I would also defer to a legal opinion on that.
Okay. Senator Corcoran.
It just occurs to me that we probably couldn't have passed the Oregon organic food law if this bill had been in effect at the time.
Chairman Shields, Senator Corcoran, if the USDA National Organic Program was in place, your statement would be correct.
It could not.
If it was not in place, as I read it, we could have adopted the Oregon organic law.
Okay.
I understand what you're saying. Any other questions? Okay. Maureen, go ahead.
Yeah, was the organic food law, was that passed by the legislature?
Mm-hmm. Senate Bill 400. Beg Joel.
Okay. So I guess my point would be that if that's the case, the legislature changes statutes.
Right. But my point is that let's say that the federal law had preceded the state law.
Mm-hmm.
If this was in effect, then any kind of state legislation dealing with organic product could not have taken effect under this bill because there would have been a federal standard.
Well, I guess my point would be that this only says that an agency couldn't impose a rule or a law. The legislature could have changed the law and said...
And through whom would we do that? The agency.
But if just like the amendment for the wine industry, if we adopt it in this bill, says, you know, with the exception of wine, wine can do this. We can change the law.
We would have to change this law, my point.
Yeah.
So we would pass the law in order to change it.
Yes.
Oh, okay. That's a good thing.
Real quickly, I want to give Maureen a couple minutes to make some comments. Okay? I realize some of us have appointments, so we got to hurry off.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Shields, members of the committee. I am, for the record, I'm Maureen Kirk. I'm the executive director of Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, and I'm here today to respectfully urge your opposition to this bill. I have written comments, which I will submit in lieu of any lengthy testimony. The main thrust of my comments and the information I'm bringing forward that's unique is to remind the committee of occasions when there was such an acute harm pending that the state of Oregon took steps and other states have taken steps to get ahead of the federal regulations in order to protect consumers. I do believe that food labeling requirements are there to protect and inform consumers, and that in several rare but well-considered occasions, Oregonians have relied upon the state to protect them where the federal government has not done so. One of the examples was referred to earlier. It's the example of sulfites, where a death of an Oregon girl from eating food treated with sulfites in a restaurant led to a national and quicker than the national, a state action that was important to ban, in the end, ban sulfite use, but labeling and restrictions were also considered as part of a remedy for that. So that would be an important example to consider. And the other example had to do with ephedra, which is a more current example of a food additive which needs labels, and many states have acted ahead of the FDA in labeling ephedra, which has some serious health effects and was responsible for the death of a Major League Baseball player recently from Oregon. So those were the main examples I was going to illustrate for the committee. I can provide this testimony and then any follow-up that you'd like after.
I would like to have your written testimony.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there any questions? If not, our committee is adjourned.